I don't know what most white people in this country feel. I can only include what they feel from the state of their institution. Now, this is the evidence. You want me to make an act of faith, risking myself, my wife, my woman, my sister, my children, on some idealism which you assure me exists in America, which I have never seen.
So we have a return guest who is one of my dear friends, and she is my shero, an amazing woman doing astounding work in sunny South Dallas, Cecily Smith with Abide Women's Services. Welcome back, Cecily.
I am so happy to be back, Katina.
We are so happy to have you back. Yeah, we have Black Maternal Health Week coming up next month, and this is the perfect time to check in with you and see what's going on with you and with Abide. There have been so many advancements and new things happening in the past couple of years. But first, we got to know for the listeners who haven't met you before through our podcast, tell us, who is Cecily Smith?
Who is Cecily Smith? I am a Black woman, a liberator, a mother, a wife, a justice seeker, and a member of the crew tribe that would originally be in modern day Liberia. That's who I am. I started Abide because I was absolutely blown away by the devastating statistics amongst Black women and our babies. And that's what I do. Like, I lead an organization here in sunny South D that is a maternal justice organization. And we are dedicated to reducing the disparities in Black infant and maternal health outcomes. And so that's who I am right now today.
Phenomenal. So you said you're a member of the crew tribe. Before we get deeper into the episode, what does that connection mean to you? Tell us a little bit about that tribe in Liberia. And what does that connection mean to you when you think of the work that you're doing? And how do you feel like that the legacy of knowing your tribe and the tribe itself, how does that influence the work that you're doing?
Yes, I'm so glad that you asked that, because it's really my ancestors, the people of the crew tribe, they run in my blood. And when you ask me, who am I? That's who I am. It's not what I do. And so it was several years ago, I learned from my mother's side of the family that we derive from the crew people, the crew tribe. And as I did my research, I learned that the crew tribe were known to resist colonization. They were navigators of the seas. They essentially gave colonizers hell, and they were ruthless in their pursuit of being free. And they would rather end their own lives than to be captured. And so when I learned of that, it brought me to tears. My heart was swelled and everything, because it very much aligns with my purpose in life. And yeah. I literally had no idea, but it completely makes sense that my ancestors were the crew people, because this is exactly what I'm doing now. It's like resisting oppression, resisting this notion that we are not deserving of adequate care, resisting systemic racism and systemic oppression. It's in my blood. So yeah, that's how it ties into the work I do today.
And if you could imagine that colonization had never happened and you were born amongst your people, what would you imagine your life would be like?
Wow. Well, one, I would be speaking a language that I have no idea, you know, what it is now.
Right.
I would be participating in a culture that is rich and dynamic and beautiful, knowing that historically, the crew people were navigators of the sea means a lot. That means that they were fishermen. They knew how to navigate the waters. And because of their fish resistance to colonization, I believe that kind of translates into just being incredibly strong and loyal and committed to their families, to their culture. And so I would see myself as that, like being just like going in on with my people, you know? And I feel like I'd have more community than I do today. Yeah. It's a lot of richness, I believe, that I've missed out on that I know that I would have been part of had I known and had we not been, you know, colonized and enslaved.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Awesome. Awesome. Okay. Well, let's...
Thank you for asking that question.
Yeah. I believe that taking moments to pause and think of that is huge, because who we are today is shaped so much by, especially in this land, by oppression. But we are a people that exists beyond that, the 400-year space and time that brought us here. And so being able to pause and just imagine ourselves beyond that 400 years, knowing that, you know, God is eternal, and that we have, you know, being able to even understand, like, to connect to our forefathers and mothers and ancestors. I mean, that's powerful, because many people aren't even afforded that. So, yeah, I think it's awesome to just be able to pause and imagine, because it fuels us, right? So let's jump into, because again, we're celebrating, well, not celebrating, but we have Black Maternal Health Week coming up next month. And in a lot of ways, Abide is celebrating and amplifying the Black maternal voice, but also the Black midwifery tradition. And so we want to focus on celebrating Black midwifery and advancing maternal care. So let's talk about the legacy of Black midwives.
Yeah, absolutely. So one of the things, I'm really excited about Black Maternal Health Week, because not only is it a week where we're bringing awareness, we're essentially bringing awareness of the disparities, but oftentimes those disparities can be really traumatizing, you know? And so being able to like bring awareness, but also celebrate, is really powerful. But yes, as far as Black midwifery, I think it's just it's rich. And I had no idea until I got into this work. There is a history, I would say a hidden history in Black midwifery that a lot of people just aren't really unaware, that in the 1900s, there were thousands of Black midwives who worked in the South, like delivering Black and white babies. You know, I say to this day, like, Black midwives birthed the nation, Black women birthed the nation. You know, Black women were catching everybody's babies, Black, white, you know, and they brought their cultures, you know, their ancestral wisdom and knowledge. Black midwives and indigenous native midwives have their indigenous culture and practices like really deeply rooted in midwifery. And there's so much that we can learn from midwives. But it's unfortunate, though, that I believe it was in the 1980s that midwifery or midwives overall were systemically pushed out of the healthcare system. And yeah, you know, by the 1980s, they were essentially pushed out by the healthcare system. Yeah. And what was in the 1920s through the 1930s, it was really the medicalization of childbirth is essentially what began that push.
Yeah. And when you say the medicalization of childbirth, those words are so, they cut like a knife, like literally and figuratively, they cut like a knife. Because when a part of our experience in this country is that maternity it's been forced upon us, and so it impacts the way Black women, especially, I would say, from the civil rights era, and even when we're looking at the time of redlining. And, you know, being stigmatized as the welfare queen. From that on back to enslavement, there is a sadness that is associated with being pregnant and having children, when it should be something that is beautiful and empowering. And, you know, it's a miracle. It's something that only our bodies can do. Like, it's something that should be celebrated, but that being taken from us. When we look at throughout Africa and we see these beautiful images mm-hmm. of Black women swaddling their babies and taking their children wherever they go. And, you know, just this beauty of, and when you look at any culture of Black, Indigenous, and, you know, just these beautiful images of motherhood that was lost on us in some ways because of how motherhood was enforced and regulated upon our, yes. our bodies, which also afflicts our minds. And when you think of the medicalization and how the medicalization, like the procedures and the processes were experimented on Black women's bodies, mm-hmm. how section was perfected on Black women's bodies, enslaved Black women. And what I love about Abide is that you are taking back our experiencing. You're taking back our experience and redignifying our experience,
yes.
as well as reconnecting us. I mean, you, Abide, as well as all over the country and all over the world, we are taking back. It's a reparative work. It's reparations in itself that we are taking back our maternal experience. Mm-hmm. And I think that there is so much power in that when we think about intergenerational trauma and that recapturing or taking back our experience, our maternal experience, our pregnancies, our, you know, taking that back, then we can move the next generation forward in a way that is different. And I just think about that. I don't even really have all the words for it, but just the power in that. I remember when you had our precious baby.
Yes.
And the community baby. Yes, the community baby. And we were all on Marco Polo, and even it was shared with women all over the place. Like we were all over the place. And mm-hmm. we got to partake in your birthing experience via Marco Polo, and everybody just shared, you know. And I remember yeah. just being in tears and just saying, watching you own that experience, knowing that in my experience with my oldest child, that it was taken from me in the same setting that so many Black women experience it, where we have a racist, you know, doctor mm-hmm. who just inflicted pain upon me, you know, just all these things that are very common in our experience. And then the postpartum experience, watching your birthing experience was so healing for me and gave me so much hope. And I see that in your life, but I also see that in your work and what you're doing in Abide. I think it's so powerful. I mean, I think that reparations begins with birth, because it begins with life and yes. and transitioning the next life forward. You know, it begin like from our ancestors to us, from us to our, you know, our children. Can you speak absolutely. To that?
Yes, absolutely. So I'm kind of reminded of a quote from the late grand midwife, Claudia Booker. And I was in 2019, this was when I was pregnant with that community baby. Yes. I was sitting right next to her at a convening of birth workers of color in Austin, mm-hmm. Texas. And this convening was so restorative. It was so healing. It was in a time where I personally needed it so bad. But I was sitting next to her and we were all just talking about our experiences. And she just said out loud, "We've been doing this for thousands of years." Mm-hmm. And the context of that was her sharing that us as Black and Indigenous people, we have been birthing babies. We've been catching babies. We've been loving our babies. We've been restoring our communities. We've been breastfeeding our babies. We've been carrying our babies. Like, we've been doing this for thousands of years. And she said that because, and it was to encourage us to step into our power, and that we can't wait for other people to fix and to repair the damage that has been done historically. And mm-hmm. that moment in 2019 changed me. It changed me forever. And it gave me a renewed and purpose and understanding of how I wanted to birth my last baby. It in that moment, I believe, was when I knew that I wanted to be surrounded by Black women, that that was the birth that was going to bring healing, you know, for, you know, I was really thinking about myself. I had no idea that it was really going to impact you the way that it did, that that birth would bring healing amongst so many of us. And so I think that the repair, although it wasn't our fault, everything that's been done to right. Black women, the experimentation, the enslavement, the breaking away of the bond that mm-hmm. Black women have had with our children, with our babies, it began the moment that they ripped us from our homes in our ancestral lands. And then they made childbirth and our children a commodity mm-hmm. for this country. And so what we're doing now is we're saying no more. Black birth workers from all over the country are saying no more of this. You know, we're resisting the systems and we're creating new ones. And we're saying that we're essentially saying enough. Because if we go, you know, along the timeline just of Black women being ripped from our babies being ripped from our bodies, or no, us being forcibly, essentially bred to bring more, not children to the oppressor into the world, but to breed more slaves, essentially to them, for us to be not breastfeeding our own children, but breastfeeding the enslaver's wife's children.
The oppressor's children.
The oppressor's, yeah. There we go. The oppressor's children to being sterilized, you know?
Yes.
Fannie Lou Hamer, sterilized, yes. Yes. You know? There's just been a history in this country of Black bodies being used and abused and us taking away the thing that is essentially within us, that is embedded within us, and that is a tender compassion and love for our offspring, yes. for the ones that we bring into the world.
Yes.
And so being able to say, like, no, we're going to build more Black midwives and Indigenous midwives. We're going to birth on our terms. We're going to resist the systems that are not built for our best interest is us. That it is reparations. That is yes. us repairing. It's taking reparations into our own hands.
Well, absolutely. And this is such an important conversation. And even now, as we are seeing the various genocides that are happening, and I have to just kind of do a caveat and address these things because I think that is so important. And I know that a lot of times our listeners will say, don't talk about religion, but you can't tell a Black woman what to talk about, one thing. And you can't tell a Black woman not to talk about spirituality, because so much of who we are, wherever we land spiritually, is what has gotten us throughout the diaspora.
Yep.
So listeners, you just gonna have to deal with it. So here's the thing. As we're seeing the various conflicts, well, not conflicts, genocides, and we're talking about the Congo, we're talking about what's going on in Haiti, and of course, we're talking about what's going on in Palestine. When you look at some of the most significant acts of resistance, and when you think about the Bible and how the Bible itself encompasses origin stories for really all three of the major religions, when you think about Christianity, Judaism, and Islam, you go back to Abraham and Sarah. Sarah was a Karen. Everybody can catch it. Sarah was a Karen. She's the first Karen that I can think of. You know, we're going to leave Eve alone. But Sarah was a Karen. She made Hagar, who was a princess that was enslaved, she forced her to have sex with Abraham. Hagar runs away. God meets her. He encourages her in her situation. She goes back and she has the oppressor's baby. Karen, Sarah, then gets mad after the baby is born and wants to send him away because he's teasing her child that she should have waited on God for in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
Hagar gets sent back out to die. And God meets her and says, I'm going to take care of you. and your children shall be numerous. He gives her a blessing. Okay. And so she goes forward, and here we are today. So that's just when you think about birth as resistance. And then the next story that I think of is the Hebrew, and actually, when I think of Moses' mother in an act of resistance, put her baby in a basket to save her baby and save their, you know, basically preserve their bloodline, and how Moses is hidden in the oppressor's house. And when we think about Black women, we are existing and being exposed and being brutalized, but we're being hidden and kept in the oppressor's house. And everything that we are restricted from and kept from is still afforded to us, because we find ways to snatch those things, those resources, and utilize them for ourselves, as well as draw back from our own experiences when they move forward with us, even as much as they try to suppress that and keep that away from us, keeping us from singing, keeping us, you know, like we could only sing, we couldn't read, we couldn't speak. And we found ways to communicate in our hair, in our, you know, in our cornrows, like I got some right now in my head, in our singing, in our art. When we think about the building of churches and how there were stories like in the woodwork, and it's like birth is power, and it's the first thing that gets afflicted. It's the first thing that the oppressor goes for, any oppressor. When you think about oppression throughout the history of the world, the first thing that they go for is birth. Life, you know, the first thing they go for is life and the sanctity of life and birth itself. And so I just think it's so powerful that we have these stories that have been co-opted and have been made into, like, they've been hyper-spiritualized and they've been, you know, tainted and they've been bastardized. And when you go back to those stories through a decolonized lens and a deconstructed lens, you see the power that women who have been oppressed, that we have, and how we found ways to move forward and push the next generation forward and preserve the next generation right there in the very stories that have been used to afflict us. So absolutely. I have to just, as you're speaking, I have to just pause and say, like, birth is power. And speaking to Black women right now who are listening, and, you know, when we think there's so much negativity with our experience in this land, but there's so much power, and so much so that the oppressor sought to just squelch, you know, piss on our legacy of being midwives, of birthing enslaved babies, of hiding enslaved babies, of keeping them alive when the oppressor said to kill them. There's so much power in the Black and Indigenous and oppressed peoples. The you know, when we think about what's going on in Palestine right now with children and how people are giving their lives to fight for the babies, there's so much power. And I'm sorry, I just had to insert that.
Sorry,
because
I
feel like there's such a great connection there.
There is. And I want to kind of piggyback on it, because I think that you're really touching on a great point, is Black women are magical. Yeah. And everything that you're saying about our power, I believe they know.
Right.
Like, they know about our power. And it kind of reminds me about how so much of what Black and Indigenous people bring to the plate, how much of it is constantly appropriated.
Yes.
Like, you think about it, like, it's the appropriation of baby wearing, I even say that birth centers, like, essentially, like, are.
Yes.
Is the word appropriation? Is it appropriation?
The gentrification of. Yes. Yes. Yes.
Like, because, you know, in the 1940s and through the 1940s and 1960s, what they did is, like, white doctors and public health officials, they began campaigns to persuade women to abandon Black midwives. But then, of course, again, the medicalization of it. It's like, okay, all of this stuff that is good, that is whole, that is righteous. They want to like strip from people and control it, knowing that it's good. But yeah, you're going to say something, Katina?
No, I'm just listening. I'm just taking just in what you're saying.
Yeah, it's just, you know, it's just wild because like when I think about Black maternal health and the disparities and, you know, Black women diet 3 to 4 times the rate of white women due to childbirth related causes. But we know that 90% of these deaths are preventable. You know that there's something up. Yeah. If you know that it's preventable, then why aren't we fixing it? Because the system is set up the way it was intended to.
Yeah.
To not honor, to not respect, not to hold tenderly Black lives. Like, it's intentional.
And we even talked about it in another episode where Garen brought out the point that there was a whole propaganda machine to make Black women bad mothers that started up towards the end of slavery. Is that correct, Garen? It was like, let's paint Black women as bad mothers. But while they still nurse our babies and while they still, you know, take care of our children while we, you know, and we don't. Garen, do you remember that episode?
I do. I don't have those notes pulled up. But yeah, the stereotypes just kind of did a quick 180 based on just the cultural needs of the white majority culture and what they were trying to get from the Black population. So I can pull up those notes while we continue.
Yeah, but there was a whole thing about all of a sudden Black women are the most horrible mothers. And that narrative continues even to this day, even though there are real data out there that suggests completely the opposite. And I want to talk about, go ahead.
Yeah, you even think about like you hear often say people saying, well, why aren't black families adopting? I'm sorry. We take care of our own. Right. Like we don't go through the system, because if we know that something's going on in our family, we're taking in our cousins and absolutely. Like we do that.
And been doing it. And we were forging our families together during enslavement, as children were being like farmed off, like sent off to other places, and people were being, it's like, take care of my baby. I'm being separated from my baby. And I need you to take care of my baby in this place because I'm being separated and moved to this other place. That, mm-hmm. you know, we are very communal. And I know both my parents were raised by my mom, by her grandmother, my dad, by his great grandmother, with a host of cousins and siblings, just taking in babies, literally, in some cases, babies being left on doorstep, just taking in other folks' children while living in abject poverty in rural Tennessee. And so, yeah, adoption is a word that exists. But for us, it's just we just help each other out. I'm going to take this baby while you go. You got to go up north and work. I'm going to take this baby. I'm going to raise we'll raise our nieces. We'll raise our nephews. We'll raise our, you know, just taking in folks' children.
Right. And I mean, this kind of reminds me of just capitalism, or let me just say like the love of money. Because I mean, when you really think about like the root of a lot of the sins of the forefathers and the systems that are in place, the root ends up being pointed to the love of money. Like, how can we profit off of this and that? This is why, you know, C-sections are profitable. C-sections are profitable. People, hospitals get paid more, doctors get paid more if you cut, you know?
Yeah.
It's not profitable for people to go to midwives. Nope. You know, it's profitable to go to the hospital. You know,
exactly. It's not profitable to nurse your baby.
Right. Right.
And that is not to, you know, because I nursed and had to supplement with, that's not to come against mothers who've had to do what they've had to do, but it is profitable to do formula. Somebody's making major bucks. And human capital, human beings as capital is a huge part of this as well. So, yeah. So let's talk about the midwives that have had such a major influence on you and you know, just give us a little bit of their stories and say their names.
Yeah, absolutely. So as mentioned before, Claudia Booker, affectionately, you know, when we, within the, amongst Black birth workers, when a midwife has reached grandness, you know, we call them Mama Claudia Booker. It's like an affection that we hold for them. Yeah. And so she really did something to me in 2019. My biggest mentor is Jenny Joseph. Like, Jenny Joseph is the one that shared all the disparities regarding, you know, just about infant and maternal health in this country. I learned about all of this back in 2013. I have to say that I didn't get into this work from trauma. I did the research. I had my babies at home or a birth center, and I had a great midwife, but I didn't realize the depths of what was going on until I was exposed to it. And then I started listening to people, you know, yeah. So I was exposed to these disparities from Jenny Joseph, and she's a Black British trained midwife who's been practicing midwifery here in this country for over 35 years. Was it 2 years ago? She was one of Time Women's Women of the Year. Like, she is internationally known. And so yeah. I was introduced to these disparities in 2013, and, you know, it gutted me. And then several years later, Abide came to be. You know, I always tell people that she planted a seed in me and I just didn't know it. You know, it took some years for the soil to be cultivated and for that seed to sprout into something. And now it's a young tree, you know, that will eventually grow into a forest. But it was her and her work with Common Sense Childbirth and the creation of the JJ Way, which is a patient-centered model of healthcare, that influenced the work that I do with Abide. And so we're the first accredited easy access clinic outside of the original in Winter Garden, Florida. And so she's done a phenomenal work. Like, she's been so sacrificial, and she's been integral to so many birth workers, doulas, midwives, educators across the country, across the world, really. And so she's my crush when yes, it comes indeed. To midwives. And so mm-hmm. there are many midwives. Unfortunately, our grand midwives are getting up in age, and we've seen several losses just in the past couple of years, and we do not have many grand midwives. And so this is one of the reasons why with Abide, one of our goals is to build up more Black midwives and birth workers of color in this country so that we can honor the legacy of Black midwifery and really reclaim what was essentially taken away. We're saying, no, we're going back to this. We're going back to our roots, and we are going to heal from the beginning, from birth.
Yes. And so why is that important in this moment, especially with the advancement? And I mean, I kind of know the answer, but I'm trying to set you up to tell us why is that tradition important in this moment, especially with the advancement of, you know, medical technology? And there've been so many, you know, so-called advancements. Why is that important? Other than, I mean, I know that the history and the legacy is important, but let's talk about the connection of Black midwives and positive outcomes for Black women in Black maternal health.
So there are studies that show that when you have an uncomplicated birth, you have better outcomes when you're seen by a midwife. You know, it's non-invasive. I won't say it's non-clinical, because midwives are trained and specialized in birth. And I think we've been so conditioned in our culture, like in American culture, because it's really American culture, because people are giving birth with midwives in other countries. Like, it's a normal thing there. So here, we've been so conditioned to believe an OBGYN is it, you know? Yep. And there are doctors have a place. Hospitals have a place. They are necessary. But when you're dealing with an uncomplicated birth, you have better results. Because oftentimes when you're in a hospital setting, it's over-medicalized, you know? And you may go in with a birth plan, and if you don't have a doula, you know, or an advocate next to you, you can be pushed into doing something that you don't want to do. Like, you can be pushed into having an unnecessary C-section, right. You know? And so many people are led to believe that their C-sections are necessary when they're not, you know? And when it is just simply, it was just simply convenient mm-hmm. for the doctor. Or they lead with fear instead of a place of safety, you know? And that's what midwives right. do. Midwives leave from a place of safety, and they're trained to recognize when it's time to do a transfer, if you need a transfer. But when you remove yourself from a hospital setting, because oftentimes, I think more often than not, when people think of hospital, you think of sickness, illness, death. You don't right. think of, you're going to bring a new life into the world, health, you know, all that. And so that's already just a barrier, you know, right there. And so us pursuing to build more Black midwives is for our safety, especially when you see the statistics are not changing. When we know that 90% of these deaths, which the vast majority of these deaths are happening in the hospital medical industrial complex, you know, yes. in the system.
Yes.
Then we know that there is a problem and it's not being addressed.
And so that problem starts with implicit bias. And we'll go back and visit this whole propaganda machine of Black women not being good mothers and how mm-hmm. that impacts the outcomes for Black maternal health and infant mortality, because how you see and perceive a Black woman to be, thinking that we have higher pain tolerances and,
yep.
you know, how those things impact the outcomes. And Gary, you found those notes. You want to?
Yeah. So just, we can insert this back in the other part of the episode, or we could keep it here. But the walking through the history of the changing views of the white population towards Black women based on just the pragmatic, like profit driven needs of white culture at the time is what I want to kind of show here. So during slavery, there was a commoditization of Black bodies, as you have said. There's a quote here from one plantation owner who said, "I own a woman who cost me $400 when a girl in 1827. I admit she made me nothing, only worth her provisions and clothing. But now she has three children worth over $3,000. I would not this night touch $700 for her. Her oldest boy is worth $1,250 cash, and I can get it." So just this, I mean, they're just discussing that quote just exemplifies, they're just discussing the value that they could have from Black children born to enslaved women as if it's just a commodity. And yeah. in addition to that, I mean, there was loans that they could get that they could back with Black children. They would actually use collateral, like human collateral, to back loans the way that we do with mortgage loans now in order to expand their operations. Thomas Jefferson said, "I consider a woman who brings a child every 2 years as far more profitable than the best man on the farm." So there was this view where women had to get their Black enslaved women to have more babies and for the profit motive. And so they would give extra rations. They would give Saturdays off. P.C. Winston, on his estate and his plantation manual, he described that women with six children alive at any one time are allowed all Saturday to themselves. And there were, on some estates, women would actually be given their freedom for having 12 children. So they gave these incentives for women to have children. They also used, like, on a more kind of wicked side, they would use master rape or studs. They would force Black men to have sex with enslaved women or as a form of breeding. And you've heard us reference that many times on this show, but this is like real stuff that happened across the country. In the case of master rape, in Louisiana, the rape laws explicitly excluded Black women from its protection. Like, the legislators went out of their way to write an exception that it wasn't rape if it was a Black enslaved woman. And although other laws in places like Virginia, for example, they didn't explicitly exclude Black women, there's not a single reported 18th century case of a white man being prosecuted for raping a slave. And there's even aside from that, the black women wouldn't have been allowed to testify in court. In most Southern states, the testimony of a black person against a white owner wouldn't be valid. It couldn't even be registered into the court. But then after emancipation, the incentives kind of changed because all of a sudden the white population, when slavery ended, they didn't have a financial reason to continue to keep the birth rates high among the black population. And so the stereotypes kind of flipped to the Jezebel and the Mammy. And both of those were stereotypes that were used to justify different kinds of wickedness. So the stereotype of the Jezebel was the stereotype that you can see in popular culture and art at the time, where black women were painted as just having this insatiable desire for sex. And that was used to justify rape that was very common in the sharecropping system, and to basically justify it by kind of giving this idea that black women wanted to have sex rather than that it was rape or forced upon them. And then there's the stereotype of the Mammy that was used to justify that black women were oftentimes forced out of their own homes through either, you know, compulsion or economic necessity. Oftentimes their debt was utilized to compel as well. Black women were forced out of their homes to care for, to neglect their own and to care for the white children of the estates. And so the stereotype of the Mammy was used to basically paint the picture of black women as having this deep desire to care for these white kids, but having the idea that they said that she was a bad mom, but a good maid. She had this deep desire to care for the homes and the children of the white family, but this immoral neglect of her own children. So Census Marshall, So when a one-month-old slave girl named Harriet died in the Aberville district of South Carolina in December 9, 1849, the Census Marshal reported the cause of death as being smothered by carelessness of her mother. And went on, the Census Marshal, Charles Pillow is his name, he went on to explain, "I wish it to be distinctly understood that nearly all the accidents occur in the Negro population, which goes clearly to prove their great carelessness and total inability to take care of themselves." And I mean, this guy's an official who's writing this just clearly racist view to advance this horrible stereotype. And let me see, I have other notes I can look through, but it's just, yeah. You can see these just dehumanizing, horrible stereotypes that were used. And you can, if you link it up with the profit motives at the time and what the white population, like the narrative that they wanted either to justify their sin or to try to drive birth rates up or down or to justify the commonness of mammies being taken into care for white children, the stereotypes just kind of followed the needs of the oppressive culture.
And we see those, that pattern, it still exists today in the current cultural context of the hypersexuality of black women not being good mothers, and even in how the foster system and the adoption system is set up against black and brown, BIPOC, indigenous people today. I mean, when we think about indigenous people and how I just saw a story of where a white woman who is revered in the adoption circles and a young black man who was adopted by white parents, white people, his experience, his story. So many black kids are coming out with these stories of having been adopted by white people who were racist and basically using them as a part of to get a check from, you know, from the foster care system. And he calls her out because she literally goes on TikTok and she's helping people to work around the loopholes so that she's adopted like all of these indigenous kids. And it's like a badge of honor for her. Now she's erasing all her social media because she's being called out. But the way this information is being presented, the way she presented the information initially, everybody's just in love with her until other, you know, black adopted foster kids start to poke holes in the story and show how horrible and insidious the foster care system is against Black children. I mean, when you think about how many Black children could be in with their parents had it been for the same support that is offered to the majority culture, if it had it been for, you know, wage equality, and had it not been for systemic racism and just all of the things that throughout the generations has the intergenerational trauma and the intergenerational disparities, like the generational disparities that have impacted Black families to where they can't even maintain as families, the things that right. Black families have had to come up against.
Just to kind of piggyback on that, Katina, it's like the amount of money that is put towards adoption. Just imagine what could be done if those funds could go towards the birth mother.
Yeah.
Like, why aren't we doing that? Because again, this is about commodity. This is about the bottom line and what kind of money can we make on human beings, human lives.
Do not let me keep interrupting you. Go ahead.
No, it just kind of goes back to, like, with everything that Garen was saying, it reminds me of this quote. It's by Moya Bailey and Whitney Peoples from the Towards a Black Feminist Health Science Studies. It says, the history of science, medicine, and healthcare are literally built on the bodies of Black women. How is it that our bodies have been instrumental in advances in these fields when we still have some of the worst health outcomes in this country? It reminds me of Henrietta Lacks.
Yes.
You know, like I'm telling you, like, this healthcare system, all of it is just so insidious, you know? And it also reminds me, it kind of takes me into like the concept of reproductive justice. With everything that you said, Garen, and with everybody listening, if you identify as pro-life, I really want you to hear me right now with this. Loretta Ross, she says, what is reproductive justice? It is the right to have a child, the right to not have a child, and the right to raise your children. Everyone should have that. It's not that hard to explain. It's just hard as hell to achieve. And, you know, I personally don't identify as pro-life or pro-choice. I am pro-liberation. I want people to be liberated. Yes. I don't fit into these identities, you know, with that. But if you listen to everything that Garen just said about the history of being bred and Black women never, ever having ownership of their bodies, then it would help people to understand why people advocate for reproductive justice. You know, the right to not be forced, you know, like in the past, to carry children for other people's means and gains, the right to not be sterilized. And how about this? The right to raise our children in a healthy environment that's not corrupted by environmental racism and systemic oppression. That is what fully encompasses like reproductive justice. And it makes me so angry. And actually, I'm getting really emotional about it because I understand people's heart behind like advocating for life, but we're fighting the wrong causes. We're fighting the wrong causes. We're not fighting the systems that are bent on our own destruction. We're not saying no more. We're not saying no, stop it. This is why I have such a difficult time with major healthcare systems. And I believe wholeheartedly in grassroots organizations that are on the ground for the people and are actually listening to people's stories and actually hearing people and like understanding, like getting some empathy and understanding what people are going through every single day. There is such a huge disconnect because people see things in black and white. They're not meeting in the gray. They're not trying to understand people's lived experiences and understanding that it is the major systems that are playing us.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I agree with this so much. It's interesting that when you think about the statistics of that have been so politicized about Black women and abortion, that has been such a politicized topic. And that's why I'm right there with you. I do not align with pro-life or pro-choice, because I believe that it's rooted in white feminism, which is rooted in white supremacy. So you will not gain me as an ally to that foolishness, because what the Black women is experiencing, what our experience is in this country, is so beyond what pro-life and what pro-choice, their sheer definitions. Like, you don't get to have me. I will not sit at that table, because like you said, we are pro-liberation. And it's just interesting how you have the statistics of Black abortion that are just thrown around whenever someone wants to take a Black woman down a notch. But we don't talk about all of the disparities, the health disparities, like you said, the environmental racism, the systems of medical health care, and how they are stacked up for the many Black women who desire to raise their children, love their children, and we get picked away. We get picked away. Like, being a Black mother in this land, in this country, is a sheer miracle, because everything is stacked up to pull us away from their desire. And every part of being a Black mother in this country is a fight. You know, even sending our children off to go to school, you know, sending our children to go to college, watching them leave the house every day. It's a fight, you know, having to fight and advocate for yourself in a system where you want to command your birthing experience and is stripped and taken away from you because you're seen as less than. Being a Black mother you are a walking miracle. And that's not me trying to gloat. Like, I wish Black women, by and large, we wish that we could just be everyday people. We don't want to be magic. We don't want to be miracles. We just want to be everyday. We want the same thing that everybody else wants and can afford to have. We don't want to be anomalies. We want to be everyday women that just get to raise our children under the radar, like not under the radar. Period. Okay. So, go ahead.
Just to add some kind of statistics to some of the things that y'all are saying, the number one reason, the self-reported reason for women who are seeking abortion, for why they're seeking it, the number one reason at 40% is because of financial reasons, just like an inability to have money to care for the child, where they would keep the child if they were in a better financial situation. And then for 36%, it's timing, which that's the number two reason. And timing, you could read as like a major portion of that timing piece is a lack of birth control or contraceptives to give that ability on the front end to decide when to pursue pregnancy. And so I think it's strange to me that many conservatives or evangelicals claim to be so pro-life, but are so opposed to like more liberal access to birth control. It's just such an ironic thing that I've never understood, because by providing access to birth control, that timing piece could be addressed in a way that would reduce abortion a lot by just giving over-the-counter birth control or giving access. So, and I don't understand why that's not a consensus issue. But then addressing that financial piece, that women who are in poverty, the one more statistic, and I'll shoot it to you, Cecily. Women who are in poverty have abortion at about 10 times the rate of women who make more than twice the poverty limit. So by addressing extreme poverty and by giving women a path towards a life that they, and not just women, just like by giving the whole 50% of America, like this isn't even just Black people, by giving poor people an opportunity for upward mobility. America, we describe ourselves as a nation where we believe in the ability to kind of be self-made and pull ourselves up by our bootstraps. But the reality is, compared to most Western nations, we have people trapped in poverty because our systems don't actually support the poor in a way that gives them an opportunity or a path out of poverty. So by addressing a lot of these economic and like systemic racist economic issues, but also those spill over onto, it's not even just Black people, like white, poor, and other races of poor people are hurt by a lot of the systemic laws that were originally written to target the Black poor for racist reasons. By addressing those, I think abortion would just automatically come way down.
I agree. I want to touch on two of those things. I think the patriarchy, it's always up to women to be responsible for the birth control. And that's a whole other topic that we can do another time in regards to even hormonal birth control and the impacts that that has on our bodies.
Yeah.
And it behooves me that something hasn't been created for men, you know? So there's that. But then also kind of, I'm critical of the pro-life and pro-choice folk.
Same.
So pro-life people, my question is, we get so pigeonholed, so fixated on like their narrative of what pro-life is. Are we really advocating for all life? That's the thing. And I know a lot of people that are identify as pro-life or they uphold a consistent life ethic, which I hold a consistent life ethic, and they're my people. But then the pro-choice folk, my question is always, but is it actually a choice? Is it actually a choice?
Right.
When we're looking at the systems, when we're looking at all the things you're talking about, all the things that you just brought up.
That's so good.
You know? Mm-hmm. Those are things that we need to start asking ourselves and start, instead of being so like polarizing, start coming in the middle and start resisting the system and start really... addressing some real issues that, again, will actually reduce the amount of abortions. Because I tell you right now that I believe the vast majority of people that are having abortions don't necessarily want one.
Right.
Mm-hmm. They don't wake up and say, oh, I think I just want an abortion today. Mm-hmm. No, it's not a light decision, you know? Right.
And then, to your point, probably don't feel like they have a choice. Like the system and the cards that were dealt to them in life make them feel like they have no alternative. And so if we really want to give choice, part of that comes with giving human dignity by giving opportunity for a better life, a path forward.
Yes.
So if we're not addressing those systemic barriers, then we're not really being holistically pursuing life.
Absolutely.
So tell us, Cecily, what are y'all doing over at Abide? And tell me about your outcomes and your numbers and, you know, how y'all are putting a dent in this whole mess.
Absolutely. So one of the things I will say, I mean, I know we're kind of, from the out, but Abide is everything. Like, I have to say that the greatest thing about Abide is that we not only care about our community, we care about the people that are doing the work, which is something that is often kind of pushed off to the side, especially when you're doing this kind of work or you're doing mission work or whatever, ministry work, whatever people want to call it, is you don't take care of your people. And so we're addressing the systemic inequalities and inequities by taking care of the people doing the work. And so, you know, without going into the depths of it, like our country doesn't have universal healthcare. So we pay for the premiums for all of our staff and their families.
I love that.
So that's one of the things that we've just kind of taken into our own hands. We operate on a 32-hour work week instead of a 40-hour work week. We believe in having a better work-life balance, you know, and honoring people and not, we are not, our value isn't based on our productivity. And so we've done some systemic change within the organization that is a pushback to what we're seeing within the culture. Okay, so that's that. As far as we're expanding.
Yes.
You know, we're expanding. We're hiring more midwives. We have a team of like 20 now. We have our low birth weight is half the national average. We have not had any reported infant maternal deaths. All of our clients are walking out of our door healthy, happy, satisfied with the level of care that they're receiving. I'm constantly getting quotes from people that have come into our clinic saying, like, I've never received care like this, or I'm coming back the next time I get pregnant, or they'll see a rendering of our birth center and they're like, when is that going to be ready? I want to have my birth there, you know? And so it is very I'm so proud of my team. Like, you know, I started this, but it's the collective efforts of everyone involved with Abide that has contributed to the health of this organization and the health of our community. And I know that it will just continue to grow. We have plans of expanding to Fort Worth. We purchased a mobile unit. We have a 12-passenger van. I've said since the very beginning that Abide will be national, and I believe it. Like, we are going to grow outside of DFW. I know it. And so I strongly believe it's because we've implemented the JJ Way model within our framework of care. And then also because of who Abide is, what we've curated as an organization that truly cares for its people from the inside out. And so, like, the services that we've provided have, our childbirth education has more than tripled in capacity. We have tremendous support from United Way Metropolitan Dallas and so many family foundations across DFW. But I will say that in order for us to grow to the extent that we see growing, we need consistent operational support. And I'm talking about oftentimes people in ministries and philanthropists, they want to give to these big organizations. Well, I'm telling you now, these big organizations are doing some good work, but it's the grassroots organization that have a proof of concept that needs millions of dollars to go towards our growth. This model that we've implemented saves lives.
Yes.
It saves lives. And as a Black woman CEO in the nonprofit sector, we get the hardest. Like, we get hit the hardest when it comes to climbing up this, you know, and doing this work. We get the least amount of support. But I will say that Abide is an anomaly, like we've been told, in regards to how fast we've growing. But we've hit a point right now where we need more support in order for us to keep going. So,
and man, to what you were saying, if to anyone in the audience who's looking to donate to something that's going to leverage your money for the best effect, giving to a major organization that's already established, that already has a set model, it's just like, that's good. But giving to an organization that has a proof of concept and now just needs to scale it up to make a wider impact, that's where you start to change the whole industry, change the whole game. So I just am excited for people to get to hear about the need that you guys have, because that, man, what you're doing and the difference that you're making already, I would just love to see that grow across the country.
And what I love is that you are starting with the people on your team. So much of the medical healthcare system and complex is the way it is because it exhausts the people who participate in it and work in it. When we think about social workers, when we think about medical health workers, so many of them are beat down from within the system to where it's impossible for them to love and serve well the patients and the people, you know, or the, you know, yeah, the patients, the clients, the customers. And I love that you are first building a model for the team of Black women. You are loving the Black women within first. And from there, they are able to spread that love and care and authenticity and power to the community. I think that is huge. And even we're actually partnering to do, I want to talk about two things before we wrap up. You've been to the White House here recently, and we're partnering to do some stuff for Black women that's coming up next month. Let's talk about this White House thing. Girl, that is you. Let's talk about
Yes, yes, absolutely. So I was invited to the White House amongst many other like nonprofits, community-based organizations in Texas to speak and to hear actually about the Biden-Harris administration and their impact in Texas. And so I took the opportunity to highlight Abide and what we're doing. Like that was my opportunity, and I'm really grateful for it. And I do believe that other opportunities will present itself. So, I mean, it was definitely an experience, and I'm very thankful for the opportunity to amplify Abide's name and to share the great work that we're doing at the White House. So yeah, it was an interesting experience that I will never forget.
And your presentation was so powerful. Y'all can follow Abide Women's Services on Instagram and on Facebook and all the socials, and you can check out Cecily's presentation. And it was just amazing to see you. It was amazing to see you there. I'm so proud of the work that you're doing. And then let's talk about Black Women Matter. Black Women Matter. And yeah, the quarterly event that we're going to be doing.
Yeah, so Black Mamas Matter Alliance, I believe they are the ones that created essentially Black Maternal Health Week. And so Black Maternal Health Week is April 11th through the 17th. And so Abide, in partnership with Katina and The Fountain, we are going to be honoring Black women. It's a celebration of Black women. This week is a week where we spread awareness of Black maternal health. And oftentimes it's like, we're telling people this is what's happening. It's like sounding the alarm. But for us, this is an opportunity for us to just say, Black women, come, let's celebrate you. Like, whether you're a mother or not, you're alive. Right. Yeah. And you are here. Let's celebrate you. Let's give you a chance to rest. Let's get you a chance to eat some good food, to hear some good music, to be amongst other Black women and celebrate us.
Yes.
So, Katina, I'd love for you to share more, even more about The Fountain and what, you know, yeah, just more about The Fountain and what compelled you to do this.
Yeah, The Fountain is just a concept I came up with in a few years ago that wanted to amplify the voices and the experiences of Black women through the intersection and serve them through the intersection of culture, faith, and creativity. And my biggest focus is the space to giving Black women the space to grieve and just to lament and lay your burdens down, but in a way that really holds space for the burden itself. And so giving space to Black women to just exist in a space where they don't have to do anything and they don't have to smile and they don't have to touch their neighbor.
Yes.
And they don't have to do nothing. But even as we sing and we do like some creative stuff, they don't have to follow along. They can just exist. And so I'm excited because I believe that Abide and The Fountain are going to work beautifully together. Do y'all hear that echo?
Yes, I hear it.
That is weird. I believe that the Abide and a Fountain are going to work beautifully together to serve Black women in the DFW. So let's go ahead.
I just want to add too that I think we downplay or we make mental health about just seeing a therapist. You know, like that's the cure. That's what heals our minds and our spirits is to go to therapy. I say events like this addresses mental health. Yeah. Being able to gather in a space curated specifically for Black women is part of our mental health journey and part of supporting all of our collective mental and individual mental health. So I just really want to point that out. Like, I think that we don't consider that events like this is a healing balm.
Yes.
To our mental health struggles.
I agree.
So, yes, please go to our Instagram, Abide_women, and you will see more information about The Fountain, the events that we're having on April 14th from 2 to 4 at Blacklit. So excited. And after listening to this incredible podcast, if you feel compelled to support Abide, you can always go to abidewomen.org to learn more about our organization and give to General Operations or to our capital campaign.
And what is your goal right now as far as fundraising? And I'm glad you transitioned into how we can support Abide. What's your goal? What are some of the things that you guys are trying to accomplish? And you've told us how we can support, but yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. So our biggest thing right now is having enough operational support to do this work. We need consistent operational support, having a healthy reserve so that we are not feeling the tension of constantly having to fundraise so that we can take care of our staff. We need consistent, recurring donors that will pour into this work so that we continue and grow. The second thing would be towards our capital campaign. We are raising $2.5 million to go towards building the purchase of a building that will hold our birth center. Yeah. It's been a capital campaign. It's been going on for a while, but it's going to take a significant amount of funding so that we can go to that next step as an organization and providing continuity of care and seeing people pre-pregnancy, during pregnancy, labor and delivery, and post.
Yes.
And so being able to offer that continuity of care and having our own birth center, the first birth center of its kind.
Yes.
You know, that centers Black, Indigenous, and people of color in DFW.
From the beginning to the end, which is
what
I love. Well, Cecily, this has been a great conversation. I'm excited about the work that you're doing. We love you. I love you. And I'm so fortunate and blessed to get to continue to partner with you. I'll see you in a little bit. Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you.
Bless you, sis, for all the work you're doing. We love you.
I love you too. Thank you so much for this opportunity.
Yes, ma'am. Take care.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.